What was found in Annie Morgan's cloth bag?
There was a receipt for plums. There were wads of string, and there were wads of sort of cloth tape. There was a wooden spatula, a piece of cloth, and the context where these things make sense is hoodoo, which is a spiritual practice that is a combination of Christianity and Western and Central African spiritual beliefs and practices. And it involves magic and ritual.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Beth Judy about her book, Bold Women in Montana History, a young adult historical account of wild and brazen females and the families and communities that supported them. Will you give us some of Annie's backstory?
Yes. And this was a chapter that really is, it is a chapter that's different from the others in the book in that it has a lot of holes in it. So you could almost wonder, why did I even do it? But I was really happy to get down some good facts about Annie Morgan because there's been myths about her and conjecture. And so we don't know everything. For example, we don't know her actual age because it's recorded in many different ways. In census data and on her tombstone and in the record books that I found in the Phillipsburg courthouse. But she was born in either the 1830s or the 1840s. It's always been said that she was a slave, but we actually don't have evidence of that. And she comes from Baltimore. She was born in Baltimore, and that was a place where there were many free blacks in Maryland. We know that somehow she made her way west and at some point hooked up with the army, and that she was an army cook. And that somehow she had some association with General Custer, George Armstrong Custer. And that was something she was very proud of. But the actual details of that, we don't know. And we did find her obituary. A friend helped me, and she found this obituary in the Phillipsburg newspaper. That says that she cooked for General Custer on his campaign, the Little Bighorn. Well, that was one thing that fact that I was able to find is that really, you know, even though we would wish it, she was probably not at that battle or at any of the battles that he was at, because women really were not allowed at such times on the field.
And for those listeners outside of Montana, can you describe Phillipsburg?
Yeah, Phillipsburg was one of our famous Montana mining centers, and it was a motherlode of silver. And in 1893, I believe, the boom bust, and thousands of people left Phillipsburg. And that was right about the time when Annie actually started homesteading on her own in Rock Creek, which is near Phillipsburg.
Will you read a section of the chapter on Annie?
Yeah. Western Army life centered around the fort. Most frontier forts had been built to protect white travelers and settlers from Indian attacks. At this time, a major war over land and way of life was unfolding between the Army and Indian tribes west of the Mississippi. Some Army posts were isolated, while others were near towns or settlements. Regardless of location, Western forts were beehives of activity. In between preparations for and returns from campaigns out in the field, soldiers practiced marching, riding, and shooting. They were responsible for keeping themselves, their weapons, and their quarters clean. If they were cavalrymen, they also had horses to take care of. For everyone at the fort, daily life followed regular schedules and strict rules. Female cooks and house servants at Army posts were usually hired and paid directly by an officer or his wife out of their personal funds. In some eras, laundresses were actual employees of the Army. At other times, soldiers had to pay laundresses with their own money. Women at forts also earned income on the side by mending soldiers' clothes and giving haircuts. Some women baked delicious treats to sell to the soldiers. We know that Annie worked as a cook for at least one Army officer's family in Dakota Territory, now South Dakota. Historical diaries of Frontier Army wives shed light on the life she probably led in that role. Officers' personal cooks usually lived in their employers' homes and prepared all the meals. In addition to serving family members, cooks were often called upon to whip up meals for unexpected dinner guests, sometimes many of them, in keeping with the tradition of Army hospitality.
Is it your sense that Annie made her way to Montana via one of these roles as a cook?
It is. That's my sense. And with this chapter, I had to be really careful because, you know, I can't say anything that isn't for sure. But my sense of it is that somehow, and it could have even been in the Southeast, she hooked up with the Army. And, you know, just it was a life that I can only guess really suited her.
Your book is titled Bold Women in Montana History. What does the adjective bold mean to you?
I talk about in the introduction how my grandmother, my Irish grandmother, Irish American, always used that word. Oh, she's a bold one. And bold to me, would you like me to read that introductory paragraph of my?
Sure.
Because I put it down there, what I thought. My understanding of the word bold comes from my Irish grandmother, Margaret Hickey. She used it to describe anyone audacious and brave enough to do something out of the ordinary. Boldness usually requires strength, sometimes outer, physical strength, but always the inner kind, mental, emotional, and moral. It involves thinking for yourself and taking action, even if that action is a decision to wait or the nurturing of a dream. Boldness is not determined by its results, which can be praise or disgrace. Though often associated with the public sphere, boldness can be just as challenging in private, say in a relationship with a friend or loved one.
Your book opens with a chapter that's set in Northwest Montana with the legacy of Running Eagle, of the Blackfeet tribe, also known as the Piikani. Can you say more about the women warriors?
Yeah. It was so interesting to find this out, and I really don't think there's been enough coverage of this historical topic. Many women went to battle, and a lot of them went for fun or for a sense of wanting to protect their loved one, whether it was a brother, a husband, a boyfriend. But they were not dedicated to the warrior life. If they had kids, you know, they would stop going out. If they, you know, were raising kids, they wouldn't go out. Maybe after kids were grown, they would go. But Running Eagle, Bidam Hakan, was different in that she really, from the time she was a child, she wanted to hunt, and then she wanted to go on the war trail. She learned traditional women's work, but she did not get any joy out of it. And it turns out that there were many women like her, and I think she's probably the best known because oral history has kept her stories alive in the Blackfeet. But then those stories were written down at some point as well. There were Cheyenne women who were warriors, Crow women. Another woman in my book, Pretty Shield, writes about two in her book. That's really by Frank Linderman, but that she collaborated with him on. There was a woman in Kootenai history that I read about who was really kind of a transgender person almost, and that was true with the Crow that Pretty Shield writes about. I was doing a story for AAA Magazine over in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and I went to Cataldo Mission and was in the visitor center there. And there is a picture, there's a drawing of another woman who was Salish named Red Quill in the visitor center, in the wonderful exhibit that they have there.
And when Running Eagle was growing up, she had an unlikely ally in her father.
Yes.
What do you know about their relationship?
Well, his name was Morning Plume, according to James Willard Schultz. And he just couldn't say no to his daughter. I suspect he just loved her very much. And he just didn't see the harm in first teaching her to hunt, as she begged him to do. Then, you know, she begged him to take her on a bison hunt, which involved shooting his rifle and learning his rifle. And he's like, well, okay. And so he was her support, and it's true. And she ran into trouble from others. One gets the sense, and this is kind of in the James Willard Schultz telling, that the mother really didn't support this decision to encourage this in their daughter, and yet she didn't say, you can't do this. And then the band that they lived with, the Small Robes, people in that band also had a bit of a hard time with a woman, a girl, doing these things. And so the dad must have weathered that with his daughter.
At the end of the chapter, you write a brief meditation on the question, who am I? In what ways do you think it's important for people to ask themselves that question, and also specifically for women and girls to ask that question?
Well, I think every human being asks themselves that during their lifetime many times, or a few, if they're lucky, in a way, because it's a difficult question. And what I love about Running Eagle is that she wouldn't give up on who she was. It was, you know, society was against her. And I also love that she thought outside the box, because it really looked like she wasn't going to be able to get her dream. But she thought of a way to do it and to fulfill her obligations.
How did you manage writing from the perspective of each woman? For instance, in the chapter on Running Eagle, you write, she wished she could have been with them on the hunt. How can you presume to know what she wished?
That's a great question, especially with a nonfiction book. If there's ever anything like that in this book, then it's based on something, which is, in this instance that you bring up, how the oral histories are told. So it's based on James Willard Schultz, but I didn't really use James Willard Schultz. I relied more on Beverly Hungry Wolf. That's just how the story is told.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Beth Judy about her book, Bold Women in Montana History. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
In thinking about the critics that these women faced, I'm thinking about Jeanette Rankin. What can you say about her work and maybe the resistance she faced in the suffragette movement?
She did not get depressed. She did not get defensive. She totally went to the facts. And learned them backwards and forwards, and then used them in her absolutely compelling speeches that she would make. And it sounds like she was almost a hypnotist, like she had such power when she talked. And people talk about her eyes being so luminous and mesmerizing. So she didn't take offense that people didn't agree or that they wouldn't support suffrage. She just set out to put facts before them.
And it was a surprise to me to read that many women didn't support
suffrage. Yes. Yeah. We can never understand how a group might do something that's against its own best interest. But women, you know, were influenced by their husbands and their fathers. And then they really did believe. I mean, there were strong beliefs about a woman's places in the home. And they don't need to vote. And they have influence through their husbands or their, you know, men who can vote. And that's enough. And, you know, Jeanette had this argument back, you know, you can be a caring mother and vote. You know, if your child is suffering from typhoid, don't you want to change what caused the typhoid, which is health conditions? Don't you want to have a voice in that? And she had other great, compelling arguments for suffrage.
What were the conditions of Jeanette's childhood that you think led to her taking on this brazen political role?
She had such an interesting childhood, and we, you know, many Montanans are familiar with her story, but we kind of forget what an unusual family the Rankins were. There were many children. I believe there were seven. One child died of, I think it was appendicitis, when Jeanette was a young teen. So that must have been a big shock. They, from a young age, had lots of responsibility put on them by their father, who was a businessman and had his fingers in all kinds of enterprises. But the three oldest, Jeanette was the oldest of the Rankins, and then her sister Harriet and her one brother, Wellington, they were running a 65-room hotel, something like that, in downtown Missoula when they were like, you know, 10 to 14. They were the ones who ran the hotel. And their father was really cool because he expected this of them, but he didn't tell them how to do anything, and he didn't criticize them. And I think that's a way of nurturing. You know, it's an incredible way of parenting, I think.
I was thinking that there are several women in the book who never marry and never have children. Does that feel salient thematically?
I guess I didn't think of that. I didn't, you know, choose them for that reason. But I guess, you know, at the time, unfortunately, you know, women who had children and families, they just didn't stand out as much sometimes as some of these women who chose not to. One thing that I'm excited about women's history for is that now we recognize what a huge undertaking and accomplishment it is to have a family. And I was really glad to include Pretty Shield, and I could have included so many more who are, I mean, Pretty Shield has some, you know, quote, accomplishments that mainstream society recognizes, like a book. And her granddaughter, who she raised, also wrote books. But I just love and celebrate the fact that Pretty Shield, one of her hugest accomplishments in my eyes, is that she raised 9 grandchildren. And of course, it's unusual because that started when she was 68. I mean, I can't imagine inheriting, taking on, you know, after your grown daughters both die from all the horrible things that are happening to Indian people on reservations at that time. She takes on 9 grandchildren, the youngest of whom is 1, and raises them.
One of the things I learned about Pretty Shield in that chapter was she nearly lost her eye, and she survived smallpox. What do you know about the other hardships women in your book faced?
They faced all kinds of issues, and it's interesting because they were, most of them came from poorer backgrounds, but, you know, one that jumps into my head is the Fliegelman sisters, who did not come from a poor background. Now, their father did. He was a Jewish Romanian immigrant who worked his way across the country to Helena and, you know, peddled dry goods, clothing, and fabric. But, you know, he worked his way up to having the finest department store in Helena. And people from Helena all remember Fliegelman's. They call it Fliegelman's. It was Fliegelman's, but you don't say the L. And their sadness in life, which they didn't actually know because it was kept from them for a long time, was that their mother had died in soon after the second Fliegelman sister was born. And their father remarried about maybe 3 years later. And that woman was kind of a dragon lady. She was she wasn't really a terrible stepmother, but she was very strict. And so they had that to deal with. And it seems to have formed them into very independent, strong women. And later in life, Frieda Fliegelman faced lots of disappointment. She was so smart, and she was just so sure she was going to succeed in life and kind of change the world. And she wanted to be an academic. She was so excited about intellectual life. But it really turned out badly, unfortunately. She was not able to get on with a university because she had trouble getting her dissertation accepted. So she never got her PhD. There was anti-Jewish sentiment in academia at the time and anti-woman beliefs. And it was also sad because she was ready to combine everything and try and be a mother and have a family as well and a wife. She was a very romantic person. But she found loves of her life, but they did not ever work out into marriage. And so she never had children, whereas her sister Belle, who was a journalist, did get that piece. She married a wonderful man, Norman, and they had a family, and Belle always kept her hand in many interesting political and artistic pies as well.
You write about individual women and sisters, and what other groups or pairings of women did you include, and what was your selection process like?
Well, I really did want to not just focus on individuals, because it seemed to me that in some women's history course that I had when I was in school, there was discussion about how much of history, usual history, it focuses on individuals and how, you know, all these decisions that they made that were so great and important. But relationships are so important in women's history and to women, living women. And so I really was excited to focus on relationships. I originally had Alma as the focus of the Pretty Shield chapter, in addition to Pretty Shield, so a grandmother and a grandchild. But we lessened, and I'm crediting my editor here, Gwen McKenna. We decided really just to focus on Pretty Shield, but I like that there's a grandmother and a granddaughter in this chapter. The Greeno sisters in Rodeo, the Fliegelmans, and then I have one chapter on the Women's Protective Union in Butte, including a focus on the two leaders of that union who were fantastic colleagues and, I guess you could say, friends for many years. Although, interestingly, that friendship fell apart, and that's a huge sadness that people familiar with the Women's Protective Union remember, and they all shake their heads at about how sad it was.
What surprised you the most during the process of researching and writing this book?
I think I was always moved by Eloise Cobell, but I was surprised by how much she moved me. And when I went to the Blackfeet Reservation to do research, I was just hit really hard by the beauty and harshness of that reservation and how much a story, part of her story that was.
And can you tell us a little bit about Eloise Cobell's story?
Eloise Cobell was born around the time of World War II in the southern part of the Blackfeet Reservation called the Birch Creek area, right near the reservation, right near the border. By the time she was ready to go to school, her parents, who were tribal leaders, had actually managed to get a small school built in their neighborhood versus having to send their children away to a boarding school, which is what Eloise's older siblings had to do. And it looks really kind of like Eloise had a bit of a charmed childhood because she was so smart and pretty and did everything so well. But her mother and father really taught them lots of good, strong lessons about work. They grew up on a ranch, did all the chores, etc. Eloise lost her mother when she was in college, and she was very close to her mother, so that was a huge blow. And when she was in school, she focused on accounting and became an accountant. She worked in Glacier Park when she was young as an accountant. She moved to Seattle and worked at a TV station as an accountant. And then finally, her dad was ready to retire. And so she and her husband, Alvin Turk Cobell, moved back to the Blackfeet, into the house that she'd grown up in. And she became the treasurer of the Blackfeet tribe. And when she was the treasurer, these words that she always heard when she was growing up came back and haunted her. People would come to her dad, who was a leader, and they would say, you know, Pleat, that was his name, I can't get my money. And the Blackfeet, people in the Blackfeet had allotments of land that were supposed to be earning them money, whether it was through grazing or agriculture or oil and gas, lumber, whatever. And yet they would get very tiny little checks each year. And these were very poor people. And they also had to go through all these hoops to get the money that the government held. And the government was supposed to be acting like a bank. And these were called trusts, the Indian trusts. And there were individual trusts and there was tribal money. And Eloise, when she was treasurer, finally really was in a position to look into this. And what she discovered was that the tribal accounts or the individual trust accounts were a total mess. And she also, at that point, was able to talk with other treasurers of other tribes across the U.S. And so finally, she was like, I am going to do something about this. And first, she tried to work through Congress. And Congress, she did. They did look into it. They found that there were terrible wrongs. They demanded that the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs correct these wrongs. Well, they just didn't. They just wouldn't. And it turned out that there was a huge cover-up because the big shameful secret was that there had never been an accounting system. Since 1887, the Dawes Act, when this was put together. So there was over 100 years of no accounting and lots of dipping into Indian money. And this is, as I said, it was both individuals' money and tribal money. And so Eloise, taunted by a government official who said, so sue us. She said, okay, I will. And she did. And it was her and about, the number varies, 300,000 to 500,000 other class action members. And they sued the government, and it just was a nightmare. But Eloise always compared herself to a Wolverine that just will not let go. And she didn't. And it did kill her, you could say. I feel like it did. She died of ovarian cancer before she ever got any of the money she was due, and before it all came through and people got their checks. But and when it all was over, you know, members got about $1,000 each, yeah, which is a tiny amount. And there was upset within the Indian community against Eloise because people thought she should have fought harder. There was all kinds of criticism. Yeah. But I know that people really appreciated those checks, and they most of all appreciated what Eloise did.
One of the things I appreciate about this book is that it brings us up into the last decade. In thinking about your own life, what do you consider to be your most bold moment?
Oh, dear. Moving to Montana was bold. I didn't know a soul. I knew one person in Helena who I really didn't meet for a while. And I knew a person who helped me find housing. He was a friend of a friend. But that was, and I drove a 24-foot truck across the country, towing my car behind. And it all worked out, and I love Montana. It took a while. It always takes me a while after I move, but I sure did find a wonderful home.
Beth Judy lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her and her book at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.